mandatory opening narration. Welcome to Akatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome back, everyone. Today we're diving into a really significant and, I have to say, deeply unsettling work, Imre Curtis's Fatelessness, or Sorstellensag. We're going to unpack this one using, you know, academic insights, historical context, the novel itself, trying to understand why this book from a Nobel laureate and Holocaust survivor just sort of breaks all the molds.
It really does. And I think that's central to Curtis's whole project. He wasn't aiming to just bear witness in the way people might expect. Mm-hmm. He survived Auschwitz-Buchenwald as a teenager.
Yeah.
But his writing uses that experience to dissect something broader about totalitarianism, sure, yeah, but also about modern existence itself, how systems can dismantle a person.
He seems to frame the Holocaust less as this completely separate, unique horror and more as, well, almost a logical endpoint of certain modern bureaucratic ways of thinking.
So yeah. Exact. A fundamental condition, maybe. Mm-hmm. And Fatelessness, published in 75, it was stark, unsentimental, philosophically dense. It really defied the conventions of Holocaust literature at the time.
And structurally, it's presented almost like a coming-of-age story, a Bildungsroman, yeah, which seems incredible given the subject matter.
It is incredible. And deeply ironic, a perverse Bildungsroman, you could say. Because, you know, normally the hero learns the rules and integrates into society. Mm-hmm. Here, our protagonist, Jurgi Kuvasgiri, he learns the rules and integrates into the anti-society of the concentration camp.
Okay, so our focus for this deep dive should probably be tracking that adaptation, how we make sense of the camps with this chilling, almost logical pragmatism.
Yes, and crucially, what happens after, when that camp-forged identity comes back into a world that just cannot comprehend it, a world that wants easy answers, maybe.
All right, let's unpack that journey. We start in Budapest, 1944, Yuri's 14, and the mood in these opening sections is strange, isn't it? There are anti-Jewish laws, things are clearly bad, but there's this odd persistence of normalcy.
It feels like. Well, it's maybe less denial and more a failure of imagination. Nobody, not even those directly affected yet, seems able to grasp the sheer scale of what's unfolding. So they focus on what they can manage. Paperwork, rules, daily routines.
That really comes through when Jiri's father is called up for a forced labor brigade. The sources describe the departure scene as full of awkward family rituals, this sense of abstract, poorly understood duty. It doesn't feel like impending doom. It feels like a bureaucratic hassle.
Curtis uses that detachment masterfully, doesn't he? It's almost clinical. By having the characters react so numbly or pragmatically, he forces the reader, forces you to confront the horror directly without the buffer of the character's emotions guiding you.
And then comes the event that really shatters that fragile normalcy for Jiri. And again, it's the ordinariness that's so chilling. He's not captured in some violent raid. He's just taken off a public bus on his way to work.
Yes, by Hungarian police. Quietly, efficiently, bureaucratically. He was just commuting, following the rules laid out for Jews who were still allowed to work certain jobs.
And his first reaction is just bafflingly practical. He's worried about his work permit, right? Not terror, but procedure.
Exactly. How will this absence be explained? It sets the tone for his entire experience, this lack of overt panic, this immediate focus on the rules of the situation, however horrific.
Even the journey in the cattle car, which must have been absolutely terrifying, he describes it mainly through physical sensations, the thirst, the lack of air, the crush of bodies. It's like he's already adapting, focusing on the immediate physical problems.
And that initial practicality, it evolves, doesn't it, into this relentless, almost unsettling rationality once he's inside the camp system. Arriving at Auschwitz, the shaving, the uniforms, getting a number. He observes it all like steps in a process.
Not as personal degradation, but as procedures to be understood.
Precisely. He's not focused on emotional trauma, but on figuring out the logic, the rules of this new world. He sees the camps not as some kind of, you know, metaphysical evil or hell, but as a new, very demanding reality, a system.
A system with rules that can, theoretically, be learned and navigated.
Yes. And if you can learn the system, maybe you can survive it. This is why the main antagonist in the novel isn't really any single person. It's the system itself. Curtis embodies that idea Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil.
Right. The SS officers, the capos, the doctors, they're not depicted as like mustache-twirling villains. They're functionaries.
Just doing their jobs, performing assigned roles within that system.
Yeah.
The cruelty is enacted through methodical routine, which is somehow even more soul-crushing. Your source had mentioned Jiri noticing a German soldier carefully adjusting his own collar before waving people towards, well, towards death or labor. That juxtaposition is the horror.
That impersonal efficiency. And within this system, he finds a kind of guide, right? Bandy Citrum. Tell us about it.
Ah, Bandy Citrum. He's the experienced inmate, the veteran survivor who takes Jiri under his wing, in a way. But it's not about friendship or solidarity in the usual sense.
It's practical.
Purely practical. Bandy teaches Jiri the mechanics of survival, how to conserve energy, how to get the most out of the rations, how to lie low, how to navigate the social dynamics among the prisoners. It's a relationship based entirely on shared practical need.
He's basically teaching Jiri how to become a functioning part of this awful machine.
In a way, yes. How to adapt perfectly, because that's the paradoxical path to maybe not being completely crushed by it.
And you see that lesson applied immediately at Auschwitz-Birkenau, the selection process. Jiri describes it with this chilling clarity. His focus is entirely on following instructions, making sure he gets into the correct line, the one that seems to lead away from immediate death.
His old identity vanishes. He's a number now. And his whole world shrinks down to that present moment, that single task. Survive the next instruction, the next hour.
That psychological focus must be what allows him to endure the sheer grind of life in the subsequent camps, like Buchenwald and then Zeitz, the labor camp. The sources detail that routine.
It's brutal. Pre-dawn roll calls in the freezing cold, 12-hour shifts in that synthetic oil factory, constant gnawing hunger. The meager soup and bread become the absolute center of existence.
The narrative stays right there, doesn't it, in that moment-to-moment struggle. But then there's a twist, a turning point. Jiri gets really sick, these large, infected abscesses.
And paradoxically, this illness is what saves him. It gets him pulled from the factory floor and sent to the infirmary. Now, the infirmary is no paradise, far from it, but it's relative safety from the work details.
It gives him time. Time to rest, physically, but also time to observe, to reflect.
Exactly. It allows him to consolidate his view of the camp. It confirms his understanding of it as this complete self-contained world with its own brutal but understandable logic. His perverse education is completed, in a sense.
Which explains his reaction when liberation finally comes. The arrival of American forces isn't this moment of pure joy and relief you'd expect.
No, Curtez describes it as confusing. A disruption. The established order, the system he had finally mastered, just dissolves. And there's this vacuum. He actually feels kind of nostalgia. Not for the suffering, obviously, but for the simple, brutal clarity of the structure he knew how to navigate.
That is profoundly unsettling. And if we follow him back to Budapest, this is where the real psychological crisis seems to hit. The alienation of the survivor.
Oh, absolutely. The return is devastating in its own way. His old apartment is occupied by strangers. People he knew before, old friends or neighbors, they treat him almost like an embarrassment, an inconvenience.
They want to hear about the horrors, the sources say, but only so they can, file it away, fit it into neat categories.
Pretty much. They want to hear the story they expect, the story of suffering and victimhood, so they can offer pity, feel sympathy, and then move on. They want him to basically forget it happened and start a new life.
But he can't. He can't just slot back in as the person he was or the victim they want him to be. Why does he resist that? Why reject their pity?
Because accepting their pity means accepting their narrative, that his time in the camps was meaningless, an interruption, a void. If it was just an accident, a period of non-life, then maybe it can be forgotten. But Jiri refuses that.
And this leads us to the philosophical core, the climax of the novel. He insists that his time in the camps, that was his life, not an absence of life.
Yes, that's the radical claim. He can't start a new life, only continue the one he has. He has to own that past, integrate it, because it's the lived reality that formed him. It's an astonishing assertion of agency, claiming ownership even of that horrific experience.
Which brings us to probably the most challenging, maybe most misunderstood phrase in the book, the happiness of the concentration camps. We really need to unpack that carefully. It sounds obscene, almost.
It's meant to shock. Curtez deliberately challenges our comfortable notions. Jiri isn't talking about joy or pleasure, obviously. He's talking about something much more fundamental, almost. Animalistic.
Like what?
Like the intense physical relief of simply surviving another moment. The sharp, absolute focus required just to take the next breath, swallow a spoonful of soup, endure the roll call. In that extreme reduction of life to pure, moment-to-moment existence, there's a kind of focus. maybe even a perverse freedom from everything else, past, future, complex emotions.
Freedom from thought, from memory, from anything but the immediate need to stay alive.
Exactly. It's the raw life force asserting itself against overwhelming odds. The system strips everything else away, and what's left is that bare, insistent fact of existence. Jury is claiming that experience, that intense focus on being, as part of his life, part of his development, however horrifying the context.
So circling back to the title, Fatelessness, he's rejecting the idea that he was just a passive speck tossed around by fate, by destiny.
He insists he was making choices, even if they were minuscule choices, the choice to take another step, to stay awake, to follow an order that might lead to survival. By making those choices, he claims a kind of ownership, a radical form of freedom within the most unfree environment imaginable.
It suggests that even in the absolute depths, there's still some sliver of human agency in how one confronts one's reality.
And the way Curtis tells this story, that detached, almost childlike, rational first-person voice is key. It refuses to offer the reader easy emotional catharsis.
Right. Jiri doesn't express the horror or the pity we expect, so we, the readers, have to supply it. It creates this profound sense of unease, not resolution.
It's a masterstroke. Curtis uses the Holocaust not just as history, but as this potent metaphor for aspects of the modern condition, the loss of self within impersonal systems, the ways we adapt, sometimes monstrously, to survive.
The lasting impression, then, is this really difficult moral challenge. The suggestion that this kind of experience might be fundamentally incomprehensible to outsiders. Its power is in its refusal to compromise, to soften the edges. It forces you to question everything.
It does. And maybe the ultimate act of defiance the book portrays is the survivor's insistence on integrating that unimaginable experience and demanding that the world acknowledge it, not just pity it or forget it.
It makes you think about the limits of empathy, perhaps, but also the incredible, sometimes terrifying, adaptability of the human spirit.
And how that adaptation itself becomes a form of knowledge, a heavy knowledge that changes you forever. Mandatory closing line. Mandatory closing line. This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.